beautiful butterflies, but instead he gave me many ugly and dreadful worms. I was threatened. I was disappointed. I mourned. But after many days, suddenly, I saw the cactus bloom with many beautiful flowers, and those worms became beautiful butterflies flying in the wind. God's way is the best way. Someone named Chung Min Kao wrote that, he said, from prison. Earlier in the visit, he had been encouraged to see light returning to her eyes, though it was a light that sparked, then waned, like a weak flame in damp wood. Now she turned her head and looked at him, and he searched for the flame, but it wasn't there. She closed her eyes, and he felt the despair of his own helplessness. In truth, he had no solutions to offer Jeanette Tolson, not even a burning homily. In the end, all he had to offer was hope. He stopped by Ernie's for a white cap reader, shelled out 50 cents, and said to the affable proprietor, "Tell me everything you know about Morris Love." He slid the Mustang into the gravel area by the church as the heavens burst open in a deluge. He raced down the basement steps with the white cap reader under his arm and, sopping wet, trotted to the men's room to dry himself off with paper towels. "Is that you, Father?" Marion Fieldwalker called from the sink at the end of the hall. "It is. How are you, Marion?" "Spry. Just made coffee. Want a cup?" "I do." He took the sodden newspaper apart and draped the three double sheets over Sunday school chairs to dry. Another clap of thunder rolled above them. It was comforting, he thought, to be snug in the basement of the old church, the smell of coffee wafting along the hallway, someone nearby to call to, the rain pelting the windows. Marion bustled in with a mug in either hand and settled into the chair by his desk. "Ella Bridgewater is all the talk," she said, nodding her approval. "You did a fine job rounding her up." "I didn't do the rounding up. Ella was heaven sent." Marion smiled. "You and Cynthia were heaven sent, is what Sam and I think." He felt his face grow warm. "Now, Marion." Marion laughed. "In any case, I hope parenting isn't proving too much for you. Goodness, after our grandchildren used to leave, we were pooped for a month of Sundays, and that's when they were old enough to feed and dress themselves." "He's a handful, all right." "Jeanette's not doing so well, is she? She hardly spoke on Sunday, bless her heart." "The doctor says the downward spiral has been going on for a long time. The upward spiral takes time, too." She blew on the steaming coffee. "I saw Jeffrey Tolson the other day. I think he's living back on the island." He shook his head. What could he say? "He thinks this is his church, that it belongs to him because his father and grandfather were members here, as if half the congregation couldn't say the very same thing." She gave a mild shudder. "Oh, how I'd hate to see him come back. Some predict he'll try. It would put us through the ringer." "Once through the ringer seems quite enough to me," he said, meeting her gaze. "They say all that business with Avery Plummer just didn't work out. You know, that's the woman he ran off with. Avery left him and went home to her mother in Goldsboro." "I always felt sorry for Jeanette being so plain and her husband so handsome. Some people, I won't say who, call her church mouse. The boy has his mother's sweet spirit, don't you think? But looks the spit image of his daddy." "I agree." "Well, no rest for the weary," she exclaimed, rising from the chair. "I've got to clean up under the sink. You never saw such a mess of old vases, and there's enough oasis under there to capsize a ship." It was nagging him, reminding him of the time years ago when he'd found the lock broken on the church door. He'd found nothing stolen, nothing amiss, and he didn't report it. Then he had discovered the burial urn filled with precious stones, sitting innocently on the shelf of the makeshift columbarium in the church closet. He picked up the phone and rang Rodney Underwood. "Rodney? Tim Cavanaugh. How's business?"
"Slow, thank the Lord," said Mitford's police chief. "How you doing down there at the other end of the world?"
"Well, pretty well. Listen, Rodney, an odd thing. Puny Guthrie, JoJo's wife, you know, she's our housekeeper. She tells me something is missing from our house next door to the old rectory, just disappeared off the mantel."
"What's the missing item?"
"A bronze angel on a green marble base, probably about 18 inches high, maybe 20.
"What's the value?"
"I don't know, but it's a fine piece, very fine. I'd estimate 3,000 at least. Old bronzes aren't cheap."
"Anything else missing?"
"Nope, nothing, and nothing out of place. But Puny had left the door unlocked by mistake, and there's work being done on the street out front, so..."
"Any suspects?"
"No, and nobody was seen going in or out. No one even knew the door was unlocked."
"Well, I don't know what we can do but file a report. No suspects, nothing else missing, no vandalism. That don't leave much to go on. What we probably need to do is go on down there and take fingerprints."
He remembered that Rodney Underwood loved taking fingerprints. "Wouldn't it cause an uproar to have your men crawling all over the house? Besides, this was maybe a week or so ago, and Puny dusts pretty faithfully. Wouldn't that remove fingerprints?"
"Well, now don't you worry about a thing. You just let me take care of it. How do we get in?"
"Talk to Puny," he said, half regretting that he had brought it up in the first place. Why the angel? He was beyond trying to figure out who had entered the yellow house and wondered only why they would have taken the angel and nothing more. If he had been the thief, he would have stolen the books. Books, however, didn't seem to be a popular item with thieves. They liked silver, TV sets, and jewelry. Yet none of those items had been touched. Boggling, each time he thought about it, he felt as if someone had removed the top of his head and poured in cooked oatmeal. He looked at his watch. 6:15, and the sun was setting. He didn't feel like running. Maybe a long walk with Barnabas instead. If they had a babysitter, he might have talked his wife into coming along. He trotted down the steps in shorts and a knit shirt, then latched the gate behind him and hunkered into an easy lope with Barnabas on the red leash. Maybe a trek past Ernie's, hang a left this side of St. John's, another left at the little gray house, and circle back by Morris Love's front gate. Just then, the fattest, sleekest squirrel he had seen on Whitecap made a dash across the road. The leash was fairly torn from his hand as Barnabas leapt after the creature, leash flying. "Barnabas!" His dog was doing 60 miles an hour and barking like thunder as he raced toward Morris Love's rusted iron gate and in a flash slithered under it. "Barnabas, come!" He wiped the sweat from his eyes and saw his dog disappear into a thicket. No, a kind of loggia to the left of the house, which was barely visible through the trees. The furious barking continued unabated. He whistled loudly. Dadgummit, his wife was a better whistler than he was. She could shake green apples from the tree. More barking, more whistling. What if Barnabas crossed the Love property, went under the fence on the other side, and into the street? He didn't keep his dog on a leash at all times for no good reason. Hadn't he been stolen by the vilest drug-dealing creek scum and kept staked and half-starved for weeks on end? Grasping the top of the wall with his hands, he gained a foothold against the rough surface and managed to heave himself up and over, landing beside the overgrown driveway with a thud. He stood for a moment, still winded, and looked around. he had entered another world. Though he was mere inches beyond the gate, a few feet from the street, and only yards from Dove Cottage, he was no longer in Whitecap. It was a jungle in here, literally. The grounds had the density of a rainforest, with trees and vegetation he had never seen before, save for one enormous live oak damaged by an old storm. He wouldn't be surprised to hear monkeys and macaws and the trumpet call of an elephant. He stood still, as if frozen to the spot. Cool in here, and quiet, strangely quiet. He heard his own hard breathing and remembered his maverick dog, Barnabas! In reply, there was crashing through the undergrowth to his left and a revived fit of barking. Come, come, old fella! Barnabas bolted into the driveway, gave him an odd look, then turned and raced toward the house. He ran too, pounding along the weed-grown driveway until the house came fully into view. Spanish, stucco, tile roof, moss growing in wide, lush patches on the walls of the loggia or portico, vines covering half the house, the smooth, worn roots of a huge tree gnarling up through a stone semicircle at the front door. He looked at windows which returned only a blank and curtainless stare. Barnabas! Dad gummit, there he came around the right side of the house, galloping like a horse after yet another squirrel, which was fleeing for its life through yet another iron gate on some kind of outbuilding which was nearly obscured by undergrowth. Enough was enough, by heaven! The party was over. He dashed after his dog as the squirrel ran through the partially open gate, and Barnabas followed, his long hair catching on the rusted iron and slamming the gate behind him. As it clanged shut, he stood for a moment, swallowing down his anger. He was looking at some kind of ancient, stuccoed enclosure, an old dog run, perhaps, grown up with straggling shrubs and weeds. The squirrel was over the rear wall and gone from sight, leaving Barnabas stranded at the end of the run, barking with impotent fury. Father Tim jiggled the gate, which appeared to have locked. He had never seen such an odd contrivance to latch a gate. The rust didn't make it work any better either. Blast! He hit the thing with the palm of his hand, smarting the flesh and drawing blood. He could fairly throttle his dog, who now turned toward him with a look of sheepish regret. Come, he said through clenched teeth. Barnabas, clearly on the downside of his adrenaline rush, walked slowly toward the gate, head down. His master punched the gate again, repeated the favorite expletive of his school buddy Tommy Knowles, then gave the thing a stiff kick for good measure. Out! He heard the bellow as if it were projected on a loud speaker. Out! His skin prickled. Mr. Love, he shouted into thin air, my dog is locked in your run, and I don't have a clue how to get him out. You're a fool to let him in, growled Morris Love. Father Tim looked to an upstairs window where he thought the voice originated, but saw no one. I didn't let him in. He ran in on his own, chasing a squirrel. He was fairly trembling with the frustration of this escapade, and suddenly angry at the man who refused to show himself, much less proffer a grain of human hospitality. Take the pin out of the latch, Morris Love yelled. He slid the pin out. Whoever put this thing together ought to have their head examined. Turn the latch to the right. He cranked it to the right. Nothing. Dead. Not to mention that something was eating his legs alive. He was furious. He felt as if he could dismantle the gate with his bare hands like Samson and pitch it into the weeds. His blood pressure was probably halfway to the moon. It doesn't work, he shouted, slapping at his bitten legs. "It works, Father. It has always worked. Don't push it when you turn it to the right." Morris Love could wake the dead with that huge bellow, as if he were speaking through the pipes of his organ. Father Tim tried again without pushing. The gate opened as easily as if it had just rolled off the assembly line. He breathed a sigh of relief and wiped his forehead with the tail of his T-shirt. Blast, what a commotion! His dog's tail, what little he possessed, was between his legs as they marched toward the house. "Thank you," he shouted to the open upstairs window. "We'll try not to trouble you again." Silence. As they swung left into the driveway, he gave one of the gnarled roots an impatient kick. "Goodbye and good riddance," he muttered under his breath. "Father?" It was Jeanette's doctor, speaking in his low country drawl. "I've got a little slip of paper around here somewhere. Jeanette asked me to give you a message. Let's see, I can't read my own handwriting. I suppose that's no news." Father Tim laughed. "Oh, here it is. Let's see. The cactus is beginning to bloom." Tears misted his eyes. "She's coming along, then?" "Oh, improving, yes, yes, definitely." "When do you think she might be coming home?" 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. We want to be absolutely certain the suicidal stuff is behind us." "Will she be able to care for the children?" "Yes, we think so. It might help to give her a day or two to settle in, if possible. I understand her cousin is having a time of it, 4 children in a 1-bedroom apartment. We'll do whatever it takes on our end, doctor." "Well, excellent. Let's just say 2 weeks maximum." "Thanks be to God." He felt a weight move off his heart. "Thank you, doctor. Well done." "Father Tim?" "Speaking. Is that you, Rodney?" "All we could turn up on the back door and the knob was Puny's prints. Well, then we dusted your mantel and your desk and so on, but didn't find anything. She's rubbed a good bit of lemon oil around in there." "Right. Course, we found some of your prints on the desk doors. You remember we took your prints a few years ago?" "I do." "Well, sorry to be so long getting back to you." Ah, well, he had done his duty, they had done theirs, and that was that. As he approached Morris Love's place on their afternoon walk, his dog suddenly lurched forward with all the power and muscle of a horse. The leash jerked from his unsuspecting hand, and Barnabas dove under the gate in a flash. Déjà vu! His anger erupted with such violence he was astounded. Barnabas! Was he so dim-witted he couldn't have prepared for this, anticipated it, expected it to happen? He would never walk this way again. Barnabas was confined to the yard and the back porch till doomsday. He had been treated like a king for years and was now exercising royal privileges. He couldn't believe the stubborn, willful, selfish disobedience of a dog he had done everything for. "Barnabas, come now!" He hardly recognized his own voice. It gave him a positive chill. If he were a dog, he'd either flee the county at the sound of it or slink back to face the music and get it over with. Hearing the booming bark fade deeper into the Love jungle, he scaled the wall and dropped down on the other side, breathing hard. He didn't want to go through this nonsense again. He really didn't. He certainly didn't want his churlish neighbor ranting at him as if he were some rum-nosed chicken poacher. So what if Morris Lovett had a hard time of it? Hadn't plenty of other people? And was that any excuse for refusing to exercise at least a modicum of human kindness toward a neighbor? He was huffing and blowing as if he had done the Nag's Head wood run instead of a mile-long lap through the neighborhood. He hadn't for some time been forced to use Holy Scripture on his dog, a ploy that worked best to keep Barnabas from leaping into the arms of the unsuspecting or giving their ears and noses a good licking. Though he had no precedent for the current circumstances, it was worth a try. "I delight to do thy will, O my God. Yea, thy law is within my heart." He fairly bellowed the line from the psalmist. He thought he had made the leaves tremble on a bush. Silence. He felt like a maniac. Ah, well, what if he simply gave up and went home? Barnabas would follow eventually. He'd be lying outside their front door in no time flat, looking doleful. But what would that solve? It would only give his dog the dumb notion that he could do it again any time he liked. He stormed down the driveway as if going to a fire, whistling and calling right and left. There was an occasional thrashing in the bushes. Birds started up and flew above him, chattering. A chipmunk dashed across his path as he came upon the house. Beside the drive, as it curved toward the front door, was something he hadn't noticed before. It was an antiquated verdigris plaque set into a concrete slab and nearly taken by ivy. A house marker, he supposed. He stooped and squinted at the engraving. Nouvelle Chanson, 1947. He wasn't eager to disturb his neighbor, no indeed, but what could he do? He stood up and let it fly. "Barnabas! Is that you again?" Morris Love shouted from an upstairs window. "Yes, dadgummit, Mr. Love, it is." "Out! Out!" "I can't go till I find my dog. My dog, Mr. Love. For heaven's sake, I'm sorry." He stomped through the undergrowth at the side of the house where he thought he heard a commotion. "Barnabas, come!" Now there was furious barking at what could be the rear of the house. He suddenly felt the insects chewing on his legs, and if that weren't enough, it was steaming in here. Until he came over the wall, he hadn't noticed the humidity, nor had he realized his desperate thirst. "Your dog has treed a squirrel off the west side." Morris Love's hoarse announcement was matter-of-fact. He darted into grass that grew to his waist. Lord only knows what was lurking on the ground. He needed a machete, a sling, a hay baler to get through this stuff. Slogging to the rear of the house, he stumbled over a pile of bricks which had toppled from a chimney and lay hidden in the grass. He fell onto a jagged piece of mortar and hauled himself up. Stubbed toes, skinned knees, cut hands, chewed legs. He was biting his tongue. He forged along the endless rear of the house and rounded the corner, dripping with sweat. Aha! By George, there he was, the impudent beast, sitting on his rear end at the foot of a tree and gazing heavenward as if in prayer. His dog turned his head and gave him the sort of look that precedes the guillotine. Speechless, his master pointed to his feet, shod in running shoes. Barnabas thoughtfully considered this gesture for some moments, then arose slowly and, head down, walked toward his master and sat a couple of yards away. Father Tim made the pointing gesture again. Barnabas arose, plodded over, and sat by his master's right foot. He reached down and plucked the leash from the grass. "Forgiveness," he said aloud to his dog, "is giving up my right to hurt you because you have hurt me." He didn't know where that particular wisdom had come from, but there it was. He put his hand through the loop and wrapped the leash around his arm twice. Then, giving his eaten legs a vigorous overall slapping, he turned to get the heck out of here. He heard Morris Love laughing behind one of the many shuttered windows on the second floor. It was an odd laughter, to say the least, composed of short explosions of sound. "Mr. Love," he yelled, "I hope we're entertaining you sufficiently."
"More than sufficiently."
Morris Love quit laughing, and the coldness in his voice returned.
"You know the way out, Father."
"Yes, indeed, it's becoming all too familiar." His own tone of voice wasn't exactly the one used in greeting people at the church door. Blast! That high wall ahead must be the back of another wing, though there were no windows. Or perhaps it was the rear of the loggia he had glimpsed earlier. From the look of things, this meant a longer distance to the front, through a deeper, yet denser, thicket. He had stumbled into some kind of briar patch or tangle of vines that scratched like a cat. Extracting himself from the snare of this nasty stuff was no easy job. Maybe he shouldn't forge ahead, but retrace his steps. This was maddening, alarming. He felt a moment of panic.
"Go back the way you came."
Morris Love was speaking directly above his head. He tore himself from the vines that snarled about his clothes and stomped back the way he had come. Fleas! He yanked up his pants leg and was relieved to find they weren't fleas after all, though something probably worse. He went at a trot, trying to avoid the pile of rubble, and finally made it to the driveway, where he stood and wiped his dripping face with the tail of his T-shirt.
"There's water in the faucet behind you."
Water. He turned and saw the spigot attached to a pipe standing about knee level. He cranked open the tap, letting the sediment flow out, then washed the cut on his hand and splashed his face and head. Cupping his hands, he drank deeply and let Barnabas drink, then drew off his shirt and dried himself and slipped it on again. Thank God, what a refreshment! He was revived, restored, holy water indeed.
"God bless you,"
he shouted, spontaneous and thankful.
"I don't believe in God."
"God believes in you."
"Then why did he give me such a body?"
"Why did he give you such musical genius?"
"I assure you, I think very little of answering a question with a question."
"Sometimes a question is the only answer I have, Mr. Love." He saw a rusted lawn chair a few feet to his right, just below the upstairs window where he presumed Morris Love to be standing. He hadn't noticed the chair on his previous safari, nor had he been aware until now of his extreme weariness. He walked to the chair and sat, glad for the chance to catch his breath. What could the lord of the manor do to him anyway, dump a flower pot on his head?
"I'm sitting down for a moment," he announced, too spent to shout. "I hope you don't object."
He gazed at the view before him, the way the light slanted into the dense tangle of trees and was lost in the foliage. A jungle, indeed. Yet this place had surely been beautiful once, a tropical island within an island, so exotic and unfamiliar that the thought of busy lives just over the wall seemed preposterous.
"Let me ask you, Father, how do you find the conscience to go about preaching the sham of belief?"
He was stunned by the question.
"I don't get your meaning," he said, and he didn't. "The meaning seems clear enough. You wear a collar, you recite a creed, you speak of God. And yet, as a man whom I presume to be more than nominally intelligent, you cannot possibly believe there is a loving God, or any God at all."
"Quite the contrary, Mr. Love. I find it impossible not to believe in a loving God.
I see it is useless to discuss a high truth with you."
"Then you see blindly." Though he didn't wish to be harsh, he had every desire to be plain. Blindness, you may be certain, has never been one of my handicaps.
Do you consider your physical condition a handicap?
Well, you speak as a fool. Of course I do.
Many do not, Mr. Love. For example, there are currently several practicing and highly successful physicians with your precise physical condition.
Not my precise condition at all. You deceive yourself grossly, Father, by presuming to know me. You do not know me now, nor will you ever.
We're both being presumptuous, Mr. Love. You presume me to be covertly faithless. I presume you to be more physically proficient than you think you're able to be. Tit for tat, as my grandmother used to say. Now let's be done with it, shall we?
Out! Out!
Yes, indeed, and thank you for your hospitality. He set off at a trot down the driveway, his dog loping ahead on the leash. The shouting continued in his wake.
Out! Out!
Out and away and never to return, he muttered, breaking into a run as he neared the gate.
He took Barnabas home and went to the beach. At the bottom of the dune, he took off his socks and stuffed them into his shoes, then rolled up his pants legs and started to walk. No wife, no toddler, no dog, no nothing. There was a fierceness in him which he didn't completely understand. Maybe he could walk it off, walk it out. Maybe it would vaporize over the ocean and descend on Argentina as a minor typhoon. He felt angry at a lot of people for a lot of reasons. At Jeffrey Tolson for being cruel. At Jeanette Tolson for being passive. At Cynthia Kavanaugh for losing her heart to someone else's child. At Morris Love for being imprisoned when he might be free. He was even angry with himself. But for what? A gull started up from a tidal pool and circled above him crying. He realized then that he was running, running for the way it felt to his bones, his beating heart. He heard the sand churning away from his feet, chuff, 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 and realized he was the only soul on the beach. All this vast world, he thought, all this great ocean, all this infinite sky, and Morris Love imprisoned behind a wall in a body he hated. But hadn't he, too, lived in a prison of his own for years on end, alternately fearing and despising and secretly rebuking his father? As a believer, his freedom in Christ had been severely handicapped for want of letting go of the old bondage, of the old Adamic bitterness he had unwittingly nurtured. Chances are, Morris Love's father had been much like Matthew Kavanaugh, disappointed and indignant, betrayed by the issue from his own flesh. And who was praying for Morris Love? Who remembered him, after all, except in island legend? Instead of a living, breathing, feeling soul, he'd become apocryphal in the minds of all but a retired clergyman, who, but for the grace of the living God, would himself be a soul under the enemy's lock and key. And another thing, if Morris Love so renounced God, why did he play so much of his music? Chuff, chuff, chuff. He wondered why he hadn't been praying for Morris Love. How could he continue shirking a mission that had literally been dumped in his own backyard? He muttered aloud as he ran, panting and huffing in a chill breeze coming off the water. This was precisely why he was feeling aggravated with himself. God had found him out for a shirker. Several nights later, he heard the music as he stepped off the porch into the backyard. No idea what it might be, but one thing was certain. It was strong stuff. He listened intently as he trotted to his good deed. The steady advance of the brooding pedal tones appeared to form the basis of an harmonic progress which he found strangely disturbing. Above this, an elusive melody wove its way through a scattering of high-pitched notes, which evoked images of birds agitated by an impending storm. The effect, he thought, as he heaved himself up and over the wall, was confused, almost disjointed, yet the music seemed to produce an essential unity and power. Clutching the bread in a Ziploc bag, he stood at the foot of the window from which his neighbor usually conducted his audiences and listened as the music moved toward its climax. He might be one crazy preacher, but he didn't think so. In fact, he'd come over the wall as if it were the most natural way in the world to go visiting. He was feeling pretty upbeat about his impetuous mission. After all, this was his neighbor for whom he was now praying. And besides, who could refuse a loaf of banana bread still warm from the oven? When the music ended, he shouted, well done, Mr. Love. Floorboards creaked in the room above. Father Cavanaugh, one and the same. Your dog isn't here, snapped Morris Love. Yes, and what a relief. I brought you some banana bread. My wife baked it. It's still warm from the oven. I think you'll like it. Silence. If his neighbor didn't go for the bread, he'd just eat the whole thing on the way home. She said to tell you it's a token of our appreciation for your music. Silence. What was that piece, anyway? It was very interesting. I don't think I've heard it before. He was a regular chatterbox. Silence. He began to feel as irritable as a child. He'd come over here with a smile on his face and bread in his hand. And what did he get for his trouble? Exactly what he should have expected. Mr. Love, for Pete's sake, what shall I do with your bread? Leave it in the chair, said Morris Love. Do what? Leave it in the chair! He considered this for a moment, then determinedly walked over and sat down. He was tired of darting away from his irate neighbor like a hare before a hound. Wasn't the trip over worth a moment of small talk, of mere civility? He'd give it a quick go, then he was gone. Mr. Love, I couldn't help but notice the sign Nouvelle Chanson. How did the house come by that name? My grandmother gave the house its name. She sang with the Met and counted Rose Bampton and Lily Pons among her friends. Melchior was my grandfather's close acquaintance. You see, when my grandparents built this house in 1947 as a summer home, she hoped for a new beginning for their marriage. A new song, if you will. Morris Love's manner was decidedly less hostile. But it didn't work that way. How did it work? My grandparents could only live the old song. The old song? Little acts of unspoken violence, Father, and bitter hatred towards one another. Morris Love was actually talking with him. He realized he had been holding his breath and released it carefully. Who taught you to play the organ? My grandfather. Once he had made his fortune, he began to study the organ. In the 40s and 50s, several great organ masters spent summers here instructing him. By the time I came along, he was respectably accomplished and began to teach me at an early age. Mr. Love, may I call you Morris? And please, call me Tim. I've never addressed a priest by his first name. I find it a repugnant modern custom. You've known priests, then? You went to St. John's? Only for baptism. The priests at St. John's often came here, some to pray over me, others to drink my grandfather's French wines. The only joy I ever found in those visits was their occasional gifts of sheet music purloined from the church. Your mother and father, were they out, out? He jumped. The shock of hearing the inevitable made his scalp prickle. The tone and repetition of that furious decree were nearly more than he could tolerate. Feeling an invasive weariness in his spirit, and not knowing what else to say or do, he stood to leave. Father? Yes. You may call me Morris. Suddenly hoarse with feeling, he said, Morris, please don't let the squirrels get your bread. I hope you like it. Try warming it in the oven for breakfast. That's what we do. He examined an odd intuition, then addressed a question to the window. Tourette's? Yes, a mild form. I'll come again, he said. But there was no reply. Marion Fieldwalker looked up from the library's checkout desk. Why, Father Tim, we're tickled to see you. I'm looking for a medical encyclopedia, Marion. Something comprehensive. Given the cost per pound for shipping, he had decided against dispatching his own to Whitecap. You come to the right place. One of our retirees studied at Harvard Medical School and gave us a wonderful one, but it takes a crane to lift it. Seated at the antiquated library table, he ran his finger quickly along the text. Characterized by rapid, repetitive, involuntary muscular movements called tics and involuntary vocalizations. Phonic tics are diverse and consist of syllables, words, short phrases, and full sentences. Tics are sudden, involuntary, repetitive. Tics intensify during periods of stress and anxiety and are frequently misinterpreted as nervous habits. Many suffer depression, often become withdrawn and even suicidal. Evidence that Tourette's syndrome is not an emotional or psychological problem, but a chronic, hereditary, neurological disorder. He toted the large tome to the desk. I'd like to check this out, he said. Oh, my goodness, Father, that doesn't check out. It's reference. Marion must have noted the disappointed look on his face, but we'll make a special exception for clergy. Would you like a wheelbarrow to help you carry it to the car? Buck and Pauline's wedding was almost upon them, and they looked forward to the upcoming visit to Mitford. But before he left, he wanted to talk to Jeffrey Tolson. Oddly, he didn't have to go looking for him, because shortly after he unlocked the church on Tuesday morning, Jeffrey Tolson came looking for him. It wasn't stone from which his face had been carved, thought Father Tim. It was ice. He noted that Jeffrey wore the open-necked white shirt with full sleeves that he had worn on his earlier visit. He felt the towering wall between them as they sat in the office. He had no sermon to preach. He had let Jeffrey Tolson do the talking he'd come to do, then he'd lay his cards on the table, plain and simple. "I intend to come back to my church," said Jeffrey Tolson. A muscle twitched in his jaw. "Your church?" "My grandfather's church, my father's church, and my church, yes." Being born into this church body confers no special distinctions or ownership. You've hurt a great many people here, Jeffrey. There is such a thing as forgiveness, Father. Are you asking forgiveness from the people of St. John's? Jeffrey sat, crossed his legs, and moved his left foot rapidly back and forth. If that's what it takes. Then you're admitting you sinned? No, I'm admitting I made a mistake. Father Tim looked carefully at the man before him. There's a bottom line to asking forgiveness, and it's something I don't see or sense in you in the least. A bottom line? Repentance. Forgiveness isn't some cheap thing to be gotten on a whim. It's purchased with a deep desire to please God. It's about renouncing. I have renounced. We aren't living together anymore. You're speaking of the flesh. I'm speaking of the heart. Jeffrey Tolson's face blanched. As choir master here for 14 years, I've heard a good deal of scripture. You aren't the only one equipped with the so-called truth. I seem to remember that St. Paul said, "Forgive one another as God in Christ forgave you." Do you believe Christ is the divine Son of God? Jeffrey Tolson shrugged. I suppose so. Not necessarily. We're told that everyone who believes in Him and relies on Him receives forgiveness of sins through His name. It's not really about asking me or the vestry or anyone at St. John's. It's about hammering it out with Him. Jeffrey drummed the desktop with the fingers of his right hand. To repent means to turn from whatever binds or enslaves you. What, for example, do you intend to do about your family? Jeanette has the house and the car. She has a successful sewing business. And as soon as I get work on the island, I'll see that she gets a check every week. As soon as you get work? You're not from Whitecap, Father, so it probably never occurred to you that getting work on the island is either difficult or impossible. He heard the sneer in his visitor's voice and made every effort to keep his own voice even as he spoke. You could go across to work, like half the population here. I'd prefer to work on the island. Commuting is expensive and inconvenient. Let's see if I have this right, Jeffrey. You abandoned your wife and children to enter into an adulterous relationship with a married woman. Left the island for several months, during which your contribution to your family was a grand total of $100. You grieved everyone in the church and your choir in particular. And now you state that you don't necessarily believe Christ to be the Son of God, yet you wish His forgiveness. Jeffrey Tolson opened his mouth to speak, but Father Tim raised his hand. In addition, you wish to wait till you find work that's convenient, while your wife, currently hospitalized and without income, soldiers on with the fallout as you trot back to God's house, whistling Dixie. He was livid. When you can return to this place with a humble spirit, confessing your sins and longing for His gift of forgiveness, you will find a willing heart to hear you. He stood from his desk, shaken. Jeffrey Tolson stood also, his face white with anger. I'll come for my son tonight. Have his things ready. You'll come for your son? I don't think so. Jonathan was given into our care by Jeanette. It is Jeanette who directs his coming and going, and that, you may rest assured, will hold up in a court of law. While he didn't know for certain that it would, it certainly seemed that it should. He thought he might be punched out on the spot, but he didn't care. He felt reckless, invincible. You can't stop me from attending St. John's. You're absolutely correct. I cannot. But I don't advise it. Jeffrey Tolson uttered an oath. Our old priest, Father Morgan, was a peacemaker. You're no Father Morgan. Thanks be to God, he said, holding his office door open. The encounter with Jeffrey Tolson had shaken him badly. That evening he sat in the study at Dove Cottage with his head in his hand for longer than his wife liked. "Timothy, dear, what is it?" she demanded on a third inquiry. "Ah," he said, lacking the energy to tell the sordid thing. Besides, did this mean Jeffrey Tolson might be hanging about to forcibly take Jonathan while Cynthia and the boy were alone? He despised even thinking this. He was just getting into bed when he heard the knock. What time was it, anyway? He peered at the clock on the nightstand, past 10. Through the glass panels in the front door, he saw what appeared to be a flashlight bobbing on the porch. He switched on the porch light and threw open the door. It was someone in uniform, and someone plenty big to boot.
Would you identify yourself, sir?
Tim Cavanaugh. Why do you ask?
I have a civil paper to serve you. You're being sued.
I beg your pardon?
Are you the Reverend Timothy A. Cavanaugh?
I am, yes. His heart was hammering.
Well, I'm Bill Deal, the sheriff of this county.
Bill Deal pocketed his flashlight and brought out his wallet to display a badge.
I hate to do this to you.
Speechless, he opened the screen door and took the envelope and gazed at it, dumbfounded. The sheriff cleared his throat and stepped to the edge of the porch, looking at the sky.
Probably going to get us some rain here before long. Well, you take it easy, Reverend.
The sheriff lumbered down the steps, walked to the front gate, and got in the car. He stood there in the chill October air as if mesmerized. Cynthia called from the hallway.
Timothy, what's going on?
I have no idea. I don't know. Nor did he want to know. He couldn't sleep. It wasn't that he couldn't understand the general intent of the papers he had been served. He could. It's that he wasn't able to make it all come together in any sensible order. Each time he read them, it was as if his mind split like an atom. He knew only one thing for certain. He was deeply alarmed. It was after midnight when he dressed and drove to St. John's and went down the cement steps by the light of the moon and faxed the papers to his cousin's home in New Jersey. The fax machine was located in Walter's study, where he'd be sure to find the papers the following morning before he left for his law office in Manhattan. Father Tim scribbled a cover sheet with St. John's phone number and a brief message. Please call me the moment you look this over. I'll be at the church office by 6 a.m. He didn't want to have the conversation with his attorney cousin at home, where his wife was already in a state of trepidation over this ghastly turn of events. Lay speak, Walter, lay speak. At 6 a.m., he sat at his desk in the chill basement office, drinking a tepid cup of coffee from home and scribbling on a legal pad. Start at the beginning. I'm writing everything down. Elaine Pringle, your tenant back in Mitford, is suing you as trustee for 1/3 of the escrow funds of Hope House. Right. His voice sounded like the croaking of a frog, and he realized he was again holding his head in his hand. She claims to be the illegitimate daughter of Josiah Baxter. Miss Sadie's father. This claim seemed so bizarre and extraordinary, his mind couldn't contain it. The whole notion kept flying out of his head, even as he tried to poke it back in. But why now, after all these years? No idea. Apparently, they're basing the suit on Baxter's holographic will, in which he decreed that 1/3 of his estate would go to Elaine Pringle's mother, Francoise, upon his death. When did Baxter die, anyway? He had tried to work this out in his mind last night. The date was on the urn in the columbarium at Lord's Chapel. He had seen it numerous times, but couldn't remember exactly. Sometime in the late 40s, I think. How old was he at the time of death? Miss Sadie told me once, in his 70s, I think. In fact, I believe she said he died soon... Right, soon after an extended trip to France. He knew Miss Sadie's mother had died in 1942, so Josiah Baxter must have been a widower when... Of course, the domestic statute of limitations has run out by several decades, said Walter. Then they don't really have a case? Unfortunately, the suit is based on French law, involving an obscure treaty between France and the U.S., which was adopted at the end of World War II. I don't know much about it. Probably something that spun off the problem of occupation troops and paternity issues. He thought the whole thing a veritable hash of mystery and confusion.
Looks like Pringle's attorney is French, Louis d'Anjou of d'Anjou and Pichot, and both Pringle and her mother are French citizens. Let me look into it. I know almost nothing about French law. Anyway, you've got 30 days to file a written response to the allegations. Father Tim shook his head as if to wake himself from a bad dream. I'll call her attorney, see what's what, get back to you in a couple of days. Right now, I'm in court on a big one. Anything, he said, anything you can do. He hung up, as winded as if he had run a mile on the beach. Our trek to Dorster is coming up the day after tomorrow, Father Tim said over the last of their lunch. He had promised his new organist, Ella Bridgewater, that he'd pay a visit to her remote island home, and Cynthia had been looking forward to the trip. We'll try to keep it short, though. I know you have plenty to do before we take off to Mitford. Jonathan may not be able to go, she said. He has a miserable cough, and his nose is dripping like a faucet. Besides, Timothy, I hear there's a storm front moving in. If we had to drop everything each time a storm front moves in, we'd get absolutely nothing done around here. She looked bleak. A lawsuit, a sick boy, a 10-hour drive to Mitford, and a storm front. When it rains, it pours, he said, no pun intended. Jonathan ran into the kitchen and clambered into Cynthia's lap. Heavens! She exclaimed, wiping his nose with the lunch napkin. Now blow! We're sure looking forward to seeing you, buddy. Me too. Mama said Buck came in the other day. He's bunking with Harley. She says he lost weight and all for the wedding. Pooh's wearing a suit. I can't believe Pooh in a suit. What are you wearing? Said Dooley. A suit. Don't forget your shirt and tie, or of course you could borrow one of my ties. Your ties are too boring. For someone who was usually in a collar, he had never thought much about ties. Maybe he needed to buy something upbeat, something Italian. What time are you rolling into Mitford? About 11 Friday morning. And how are you feeling about the appearance before the judge? Not too good. It'll go well. Don't worry. The next morning, Jonathan was burning with fever. We can't go, dearest. I hope it's only the flu. Nearly everyone in Story Group was croupy and sick on Wednesday. I'd never have taken him if I'd known. I have a call into his doctor. He felt the boy's head. He looked at his red eyes and runny nose. He listened to his labored breathing. Convinced that hauling Jonathan to Dorster could only make things worse, he finally told her. Jeffrey Tolson may be hanging about. I don't think he's dangerous, but there's no telling what he might do. Looking fierce, she said, "He can do nothing here. We'll keep the doors locked, and you'll only be away in broad daylight, so there's no use at all to worry." Feeling mildly relieved, he went to the study and closed the door, and sat in the chair and prayed about it. Should he go, or move the trip to a later date? He felt God would have him go. The sky was gunmetal from horizon to horizon. It seemed as if a leaden weight had been clamped over Whitecap, like a lid on a turkey roaster. He paced the front porch, unable to think clearly, anxious about leaving tomorrow. Cynthia would be fine, she had insisted on it, and he'd call her from Ella's house at least once, maybe twice. He zipped his jacket and sat in his favorite rocker, looking into the gathering dusk. The lawsuit dogged him like a dark cloud. What on earth could be the possible meaning behind it all? Thank God Walter was more than a cousin who happened to practice law. Walter was a tough, no-nonsense attorney with a decent reputation and several heavyweight clients. Surely he could help him hammer this thing through. He realized he was wringing his hands, something he had hardly ever caught himself doing, and stopped it at once. Yet, even more than the fret and worry of being slammed with a lawsuit, was the possibility of losing a third of the escrow, which included part of what Andrew Gregory had paid for Miss Sadie's antiques, and a third of what the money had earned in mutual funds, making Elaine Pringle the possible recipient of around $150,000. Miss Sadie had trusted him to be a good steward of all she left behind, and he had never begrudged this enormous responsibility, not for a moment.